Is Seattle waging a stealth campaign against cars? Welcome to The Record from KUOW. I'm Jeannie Yandel in today for Bill Radke. And this week, Seattle Times columnist Briar Dudley says the city's plan for growth over the next 20 years is actually a plan for a carless Seattle. He says it's time to admit it. We've declared war on cars. But Tom Fucaloro of the Seattle Bicycle blog says, take a deep breath. Making room for more bikers isn't an attack on drivers. We just need to provide other options. They sat down with Bill Radke to hash out what the future of Seattle streets should look like.
If you go into that growth plan, the city explicitly says congestion is going to get worse in some places, and not just because of growth. Congestion is going to get worse because we are going to remove lanes that everybody can use, and we're going to divert them to bike lanes and things like that. So, you know, that's a policy decision to make traffic worse. Now, so then you go one step out, well, what's the effect on the region if the city makes things worse? You know, it's not either or, like you have to build streets or you have to do only rail. The thing is, there's a huge mix of modes that people use to get around in this region. Cars are the primary one, and, you know, you got to respect that.
Okay, here to oppose, Tom Fucaloro, as you just heard, the city of Seattle purposely increasing congestion. Why does that make our lives better?
The plan actually doesn't say to increase congestion. It says to maintain the current level of cars that are on the streets now, and we're going to take all that new growth, all those, you know, 15,000 people who are moving here every year, we're going to take all those people and we're going to try to get them to take modes that are a little more efficient with space. We cannot build more roads. I mean, we're spending $2 billion to build a highway tunnel for cars, and we're widening the waterfront boulevard. I mean, we're trying to widen roads, but we're never going to build our way out of this by widening roads. We have to use the roads that we have more efficiently. And that's what a bus does. I mean, a bus can carry a traffic jam in it. And if it has a bus lane, it can move an entire traffic jam down the side of an existing traffic jam and get where all those people where they're going.
If the city doesn't minimize congestion, bus passengers are going to be hurt too. You know, a slow bus costs more in lost economic output than a slow car, frankly.
Okay, so if you want cars to go fast and you want buses to go fast, then what are we talking about? You just want fewer bicycle lanes?
Well, you know, I don't want to make it into a war on bikes in this conversation, but the city...
Is that what's really bugging you?
No.
The man sitting across the table from you?
No, I'm thrilled to be talking to you about this, and I think we have some similar thoughts about the city. We both want the city to work and both want the city to be a good place to live. And the city's congestion hurts everybody. And it's diminishing that vitality. It's making it a less pleasant place. And long term, you know, nobody wants that. So the city needs to do a better job with this. You know, we've been hearing for 5-10 years now that the city's schemes for mobility will reduce congestion. You know, this stuff about, well, you know, if we take this lane away and we give it to buses, and we take that lane away and give it to bikes, you know, there's more capacity here, there's more capacity there, it's going to get better, this mobility is going to improve. Really, it hasn't panned out. It's gotten worse.
Tom, giving lanes to bicycles, come on. We don't ride bicycles that much.
Well, no, that's not exactly true. You know, what, 16,000 people depend on bikes as their primary mode to get to work, which is pretty astounding number. And that's just Seattle residents, I should say. But also, bikes can be an extremely efficient use of space and an extremely efficient way to move people. But yeah, I mean, only if you have a connected network of bike lanes so that people can feel safe doing it. Because yeah, if it's just the people who are willing to go elbow to elbow with cars in a, you know, some kind of shared lane down Fifth Avenue, then yeah, I mean, you're only ever going to have some small percentage of people who are willing to do that. I'm one of them.
Right, but we're stuck in that weird middle then. So if you don't go really big on bikes and make our streets super bike friendly, then you're not going to really click over to where lots and lots of potential riders get on their seats.
But it's working. I mean, I think that's maybe the biggest point that's missing here is that this isn't really like pie in the sky thinking. If you break down recent people who've moved here and you look at census data and how are the new additions, the new workers in Seattle getting around, it is by far by walking, biking, and transit. And this is the city's plan working.
Yeah, lots of people are riding bikes. That's great. But really, it's been flat. If you look at the census, it might have gone up 0.5% or something like that. It's totally flat. I mean, we've seen some real interesting increases.
If only Seattle were totally flat.
Exactly. We've seen a lot of increases in walking, which, you know, that's not really reflected in where the city's spending its money, though. It's spending its money on bike lanes, not on sidewalk improvements.
Okay, now we've actually come to it. He said it.
Yeah.
Basically, come on. We're not, people are not that interested in bicycling. That's what you're saying, right?
It's not, I'm not anti-bike. I know that people like to say that, but it's flat. It's just, and we've been spending a lot. It's been a high priority. It's not growing in relation to the population growth we've seen around here. It's just flat. And so, you know, if that's flat, and people continue to buy cars, and they continue to travel more, how much longer are we going to continue to reduce the capacity for cars that account for more than 82% of the trips in the region and devote it to bikes, which are really sort of stuck at 4%, 3%, 4%?
What do you say, Mr. 4%?
Well, the only mode that is going down in the census data year over year is driving alone. If the population grows and biking increases a couple percent, that's a huge number of new bikers. I mean, we're one of the handful of U.S. cities, major U.S. cities, where fewer than 50% of people are driving to work now, which is remarkable. I mean, this is a gigantic decrease, and we should be proud of this. I mean, this is, you know, Seattle should be a leader, and that's, I think, where Seattle likes to be a leader. You know, we want people to be looking at us and saying, how do we do that? And that means we got to get out in front of them and make bold action.
Breyer, you say that City Hall just assumes that driving is optional. How is driving not optional? Where's your personal responsibility, man? I drive, but I don't have to, especially the more options I have.
You know, my daughter had a soccer game at the complete opposite end of the city last Sunday, and I'm not going to load my family of four onto, you know, take us 4 hours to get there and back on a bus. Biking would not happen. You know, it's just everybody has. I'm sure, Tom, you have situations too where you got to drive. There are people who drive cars because that's what they do. They build our houses, they clean our houses, they fix our houses, they deliver our medicine, and they pick up blood, and they do all. I mean, you know, there are many, many, many reasons to look at why people drive.
I mean, I think the maybe one of the biggest things that you're leaving out is that there are a lot of people who cannot drive. You know, they're either too young, too old. They have an ability issue that makes it so they can't drive. They don't have any money to pay for a car and parking and insurance and gas.
Pronto. They take Pronto.
Well, they live within the service area. I took it to get here. And so, I mean, when you say, like, people need a car, it's like, well, you know, you're leaving out a lot of people when you say that. And people who depend on transit or depend on walking or depend on biking need a place in the street also. And that's really all this change that the mayor's proposing is saying, is that when we look at a street, every person is equal no matter how they're getting there. So we should count people instead of counting cars. And I think that that is really common sense.
Before we go, is there anything we can agree on? Do we really have to talk about war? War on cars? I mean, what can we agree on?
I think it's really cool that Breyer was able to get a bunch of people riled up about a 20-year wonky congestion measurement. I think we're both trying to get people interested in the concept because people should care about, I mean, it does sort of say, like, what do you want the city to go in 20 years? And even if we don't agree, I think we do agree that people should care.
Yeah, I'm with Tom on that.
We're both pro-care.
Breyer Dudley is an opinion writer for the Seattle Times, and Tom Fucoloro runs a Seattle bicycle blog. They talked with Bill Radke. I'm Jeannie Yandel, and this is The Record. Thanks for joining us on The Record today. I'm Jeannie Yandel, and we pretty much all know who the presidential nominees are going to be, right? But still, we're arguing about it. Here in Washington, supporters of Ted Cruz and Bernie Sanders fight on, saying their candidates are the ones who support the policies Washington voters truly believe in. But is that true? Do voters really know which candidate they most agree with on policy? Princeton University political scientist Christopher Aiken told Bill Radke, not really.
What we're doing is asking people to remember Socrates' advice to all of us, which is to know ourselves. And one of the things that's true about human beings is that they are loyal to the groups that they belong to. And those can be political parties or racial or ethnic groups. And it's those things we think that in the end are more influential in how people vote than the particular policy and issue positions of the candidates.
We vote by our group. We vote tribally?
That's maybe putting it a little too strongly, because some of these groups are occupational groups or religious groups. They're not exactly tribes. But yes, those groups tell us how to think about the candidates, and all you have to do is listen to Democrats talk about Donald Trump, or Republicans talk about Donald Trump, or Democrats talk about Hillary Clinton versus Republicans talking about Hillary Clinton, and you know that the group you belong to influences how you see the world.
So, for example, typical Bernie Sanders supporter, they may say they're voting on the issues. They're typically voting based on what? What's a profile?
Well, what we have discovered looking at Sanders supporters is that they are often not in agreement with him on his policy positions. And, you know, for most of us, that's the honest truth. It's not the policy details that matter. It's our notion of whether this candidate is somebody who'd be good for us.
But we say we're voting on the issues, on policies. How can we be that wrong about ourselves?
Yes, we do all feel that we're being rational and voting on the issues and that we're thoughtful, moral people. But it's obvious to us that the people we disagree with are often not that and are being dragged along by the people that they're listening to or the groups that they belong to. What we're saying is that's true of all of us. And part of being wise about politics is seeing those forces at work in your own thinking.
Is this voting based on your identity and not the issues? Is that more true of uninformed, apathetic voters? I mean, what about those most passionate supporters who seem like they know a lot and care a lot about the issues?
Well, I should say first, of course, there are some very well-informed people who follow things closely and do cast a pretty thoughtful ballot. But they are a small minority of the electorate, perhaps 10 or at most 15%. Most people are just too busy with their lives to follow the details of foreign policy and economic policy and all the other complexities that the government deals with. So for most people, we find that those are not the crucial things that tell them how to make up their mind. And with respect to passionate, it actually turns out that it's often the people who are the most passionate and feel the most strongly who are the most inclined to distort the evidence in various ways to support their own policy positions. And this is just as true of Sanders supporters as it is of Clinton supporters or Cruz supporters or Trump supporters or Kasich supporters.
Yeah, you're not picking on any one candidate as arousing passion more than logic. If we look at voters that way, we're into symbols and labels and identities and charisma. What does that say about who's going to win the election in November?
That's a very good question. I think most people think that Donald Trump has more appeal on those scores than Hillary Clinton does. On the other hand, Trump has gone out of his way to make it clear to a large number of groups in the country that he is not their kind of candidate. So it's just going to be the balance of those two things. And one thing we know from past presidential years is that the polls in May don't predict November at all. You have to get to August before the polls start to be helpful. So right now, I think the answer is that nobody knows who's going to win.
This does not sound like a very rational way to elect a leader. Are you saying we should change the way we vote, the way we attach to candidates?
Well, general elections, I think we're doing them in the best way that anyone knows how to do. I don't feel that way about the primary system. The turnout in most primary states is on the order of 25% or 30%. And in caucus states like Washington State, it's routinely under 10%. So we're picking candidates in the caucuses and primaries using the judgment of only a really quite small fraction of the eligible voters. And those people can be unrepresentative of the larger population. So I do think that it's worth thinking about whether a different framework for the primaries and then, in my view, a larger role for people in Congress who actually know these people, I think, would be helpful. So that's an argument for superdelegates.
Well, that'll get you in a fight here in Washington State. We're always arguing about whether the superdelegates ought to follow the will of the voter, whatever that is, as you're saying.
Yeah, I am well aware of the argument. The irony here is that for ordinary voters, they want to keep the power themselves, and you can understand why they dislike having superdelegates in the mix. The difficulty with that is that you're turning the decision over to what, as I was just saying, a pretty small fraction of the electorate, and turning it over to people who don't know these candidates personally.
Man, Professor, when you think about how shaky the basis for our voting is, it makes you wonder why the government should do what we tell them to do. What do we know?
Well, there are some aspects that the government needs to pay close attention to, like managing foreign policy with nuclear-armed states, and you probably don't want to do that with initiatives and referendums.
Again, don't say that too loudly in Washington State. We love our initiatives.
Well, I'm from out there, as you know. So
yeah, you went to high school in Spokane.
I did, and so I know the Pacific Northwest well, but on this particular point, I think I have a view that's a little different from the standard view in Washington State.
Princeton University political scientist Christopher Aiken talking with Bill Radke. He and Vanderbilt University political scientist Larry Bartels have written Democracy for Realists, Why Elections Do Not Produce Responsive Government. And they wrote an op-ed for the New York Times about that. We'll share that with you on Twitter right now. You can talk with us all show long. We're at KUOW. And now that we're talking about elections, the campaign to replace retiring Congressman Jim McDermott is getting off the ground here in Seattle. Most of the candidates for the seat held their first debate Wednesday at the University of Washington. KUOW's law and politics reporter Amy Radel attended and has this report.
Nine candidates have filed to replace Jim McDermott in the 7th Congressional District, which includes Seattle. All five Democrats and one independent candidate for that seat came together Wednesday. They gave voters a sense of the first thing they'd do if Democrats gained control of the U.S. House in November. First to speak was state senator and former community organizer Pramila Jayapal.
For me, getting immigration reform, comprehensive immigration reform done immediately so we can bring 11 million people out of the shadows, that bill is ready to go. It passed the U.S. Senate. I actually worked on that bill, passed with 67 votes. So we are ready to move that right through the House and bring that forward.
Arun Jhaveri is the former mayor of Burien. He's also worked as a scientist with the Department of Energy.
My primary objectives as a congressman would be to make sure that we implement global climate change treaty that was passed in Paris, and secondly, to make sure that campaign finance reform is completely done so that we do not have corruption of political activities by financing from outside sources.
Campaign finance reform is also the top priority for Joe McDermott, who has served in the state legislature and now chairs the King County Council.
We need to overturn Citizens United, and we have to address our broken campaign finance system in this country. I really do believe that it's what drives people both to both extremes and prohibits work on all of those other issues.
Leslie Regier is running as an independent. She's the only candidate in the debate who is not rooting for Democrats to control the House, but instead says she's indifferent to party politics.
I want there to be less partisanship, and if I'm elected, then I would work with any of these, and I think that they should focus on issues, listening to the people.
Metro employee Don Rivers has run for Congress before. He says police oversight is a crucial issue for him.
One issue that I would love to add is the issue of Black Lives Matter and make sure that we know that all lives are important, but work on it in such a way that it would help bring back peace among all of our voters in our nation.
And State Representative Brady Walkinshaw says climate change is the reason he's running for Congress.
The first piece of legislation that I would bring forward would be a federal carbon tax. I think that climate change is the most pressing issue that our generation faces. It's why I got into this race. I believe strongly that what Congress needs is a bold new generation of progressive leaders.
There were few sharp differences of opinion among the candidates in this heavily Democratic district, so their top concerns were one way of spelling out the differences. The candidates are competing to see which two will move on from the election primary in August. Wednesday's full debate airs June 1st on the public television station KCTS. I'm Amy Radel, KUOW News.
Thank you.
This Memorial Day weekend, Lisa Hallett will be remembering her husband, John. He was killed in 2009 while deployed in Afghanistan, and she was left with a 3-year-old, a 1-year-old, and a newborn baby her husband would never meet. Lisa Hallett had to find a space away from her 3 kids where she could grieve her husband's death without being consumed by it.
My children have made this immense sacrifice, and they have lost their father to war, and it is not fair for them to lose their mother to grief. And John didn't die so that we can be the ghosts, right? We just got to celebrate life. But I still need that space to remember John. And I still need that space to celebrate his life. And I still need that space to share his stories and to hear his stories. And running is the framework. I can live this life moving forward and building a new life that is inspired by who John was and what we built as a family. And the run gives me the space to feel comfortable and confident in that process so that I can remember, I can be inspired, and I can let those daydreams of the past not be something that breaks my heart, but like feeds me.
What did that look like when you finally found that space for yourself to be able to come to terms with this loss, as you said?
I would take the first few miles, and I'm just trying to escape the day-to-day chaos of 3 young children. So the first mile is, oh my God, the babies didn't stop crying for the last hour and a half. And then the second mile is, oh, I need to buy diapers. What am I going to make for dinner? There's baby food stuck in the carpet. What am I going to do? And then you keep moving on. But then 3 and 4 and mile 5, all of a sudden, the busyness and the high energy of that day-to-day life with young children, it starts to quiet down. And then maybe mile 5, it's just quiet. There's nothing. And then mile 6, it's, oh, my husband died. And that raw candor with myself, and that's forcing me to face and understand that John doesn't get to come home. We don't get our best friend back, our father, my husband. It was a new, hollow feeling. And I was so afraid that I would never know joy again. But then processing that for a few miles, just being vulnerable and broken for a little bit. But what's so fantastic about a run is that you have the space to hit that brokenness, but then to rally and then continue to move forward. So then mile 6 and 7, it's that deep breath. Okay, I've already accomplished 6 miles. What am I already accomplishing in my real life day to day? And understanding I can do this. It's not what I wanted. It's not going to look pretty, but I can do this, and then keep moving forward. And then by the end of the run, I'm feeling stronger, a little tougher, and a little bit fiercer, and just confident that I can raise my children and that I can live a life that was worth John's sacrifice.
Well, and as part of this discovery, what running did for you, what it gave you, you started a whole organization around it. It's called Wear Blue, Run to Remember. Why did you start that organization?
In the year John deployed, 41 soldiers were killed in combat. And on the home soil, we had a community of spouses and families that were grieving. They were grieving the loss. They were fearful of what was to come and how their families would be impacted. And it was a very overwhelming time. And several women in the unit, Erin O'Connor, Alice Pope, recognized the power of running. And Erin and myself really felt this need to gather the community together. And we recognized that we needed something healthy, right? If it's pooling our spirits and giving us the strength that we need, how can we take this activity and pair it with what the gift of community can give and create a support network that can help our families? And it was never this grand plan to make something magnificent. It was born of a deep desire to survive a really difficult situation. And we met for the first time in a Burger King parking lot, kind of looked at each other, and then we ran around the airfield. But then it continued. We showed up again the next Saturday, and this time we called out the names of those men who we had lost. And then we ran around the airfield again. And sometimes there were 3 of us looking at each other, and sometimes there were 15 of us. But slowly, as we met every week, our steps really became transformative in how we dealt with the deployment. It gave us a new avenue to deal with these hardships and all that grief and frustration and confusion that we were feeling. It gave us a place to remember, and it gave us the strength to recognize that we weren't facing this alone. I think everything's scarier when you think you're doing it all by yourself, but then you realize that you really have a family and a community to carry you on your steps forward that's also trying to figure out how to navigate this deployment.
This started as three of you meeting in a Burger King parking lot and going for runs together. But there are now people around the country who come together. They call out the names of the people they lost, and then they run together. What do people who are now involved with this organization you started, what do they tell you about how running helps them?
I have been astounded by the stories that I've heard in Wear Blue from men and women who faced their own losses and chosen to move forward in a healthy and life-affirming way. But I love thinking about a couple in Georgia who didn't have words after a difficult deployment, didn't know how to reintegrate, and found that in the steps of a run, they were able to literally and figuratively start to find the common ground to build their lives back together after a difficult deployment and learning how to come back together as a family.
Lisa, we've talked so much about what your life looked like and what you thought it would be in 2009, and then what it looks like and what it is today. How do you think the you of today is different from the you of 2009?
I think about that a lot. How would my life be different if John hadn't died? And it would be very different. But I hope that I am different now, in that I am less vanilla, more rocky road. And, you know, when I was married to John, I wanted 2.2 kids and a white picket fence, and I wanted things to be real clean and safe and expected. And that is not life. And it's never going to be life. And so I think that the me of today, I hope, understands that it's not the changes that affect us. It's how we face those changes and how we deal with them and how we envelop resilience in our day-to-day life that's going to empower us to be more successful. And I think that these past 6.5 years have given me the gift of perspective and resilience and, I guess, self-love to understand that it's not going to be 2.2 kids in a white picket fence, and that's okay. And that I'm more rocky road, I'm a little bit grittier, but I think that makes me more interesting and more poised to be a person who can change my community, my family, maybe the world.
That's Lisa Hallett. She's the co-founder of Wear Blue, Run to Remember. The organization now has 15,000 members across the U.S. who run to honor fallen service members. And this weekend, Wear Blue has a goal: to have every American service member who's died in the global war on terror honored by a runner or walker somewhere in the U.S. If you want to get an initiative on the ballot in Washington state, you need a lot of signatures, nearly 250,000 from registered voters. And typically, that's going to cost you around $1 million. If you want to do it cheaper, you need people like Jonathan Tong.
I've got lots of other things I would rather be doing on my Saturday afternoons than standing out in front of a store.
David Hyde has the story of one volunteer signature gatherer.
You're on your way into your favorite organic grocery store, and there's this signature gatherer perched just outside the door. You're in a rush. You got a lot in your mind. You're thinking, oh, I should stop, but I really just don't have the time right now. But how is that signature gatherer plotting to get you to stop?
You want to say something that can hopefully hook them within the first 5-10 seconds, because they're already walking on their way past you, and you really don't get much more than 5 or 10 seconds to do it.
Most of the signature gatherers you see around town are hired guns. $2 to $3 per signature is the going rate. But Jonathan Tong is a volunteer. This year, he's working on a couple of initiatives to try to rein in the influence of money in politics. This one is Initiative 1464.
Gentlemen, how are you? Would you like to help us put an initiative on the ballot to clean up politics in Washington State?
Tong explains that opening line strategy this way.
We're trying to go for something that's nonpartisan, not something that sounds like a liberal Democrat thing or a conservative Republican thing, something that all people agree on.
And who doesn't want to clean up politics this year? But it turns out it's not that easy to get people to stop and sign, even for that cause, even at the PCC Certified Organic Grocery Store and Seattle, Washington Co-op.
Hi, ladies. How are you? Would you like to help us get Initiative 1464 on the ballot to clean up politics in Washington State?
See, I told you, it's got to be like 5 seconds.
Okay. Might have to find a new opening line.
How does Tong approach rejection?
It's what you do. It's like fishing. You know, you throw the line out there and you know that there's going to be a lot of time out there where you're not reeling in fish. But when you do get somebody to sign, it really is a good feeling. It's a nice feeling.
Tong also tells me he's selective about where he casts his opening lines.
If somebody's walking by who obviously is in a hurry, I'm not going to bother taking the time. If I see a mother with a young baby squirming around, I'm not going to bother with that. On the flip side, you recognize somebody's face just from their body language, that they are smiling, that they're not in a hurry.
And then it happens.
I'm seeing a friendly face here. I'm feeling good about this.
Hi, ma'am. How are you? Would like to help us put an initiative on the November ballot?
It would help increase transparency in elections, close the revolving door between government and lobbying.
That line was more like 8 seconds, but it works. Nicole Bartel explains why she decides to stop.
I feel like I have an obligation to get more involved in politics these days, especially nowadays.
So that's one signature. It's not easy work. The rejections, the slow pace, the fact that he's got better things to do. So why do it?
I do this for a lot of different reasons, but mainly because I have two teenage daughters, and I want them to have a decent democracy to inherit when they grow up. I'm also a high school teacher, and I want my students to have the kind of democracy they deserve. I want them to have the kind of democracy they think they have when they pledge allegiance to the flag every morning.
Jonathan Tong. He and others are out gathering signatures at grocery stores and parking lots near you. I'm David Hyde, KUOW News.
Initiative campaigns have until July 8th to collect enough valid signatures to qualify for the November ballot. This is The Record. There are over 100 islands in Puget Sound, but there's something on McNeil Island that makes it different.
The island itself is fairly picturesque. There's all kinds of small wildlife that live out there because there's no predators at this point and very little human impact. When you ask me what McNeil Island is, I don't know if you meant the island or if you meant the facility.
Well, I'm wondering if this is just a slip of the tongue, but you said there were no predators out there.
That's public defender Andrew Morrison talking with Jeff Entman of the local podcast Here Be Monsters. And the facility they mentioned is the Special Commitment Center, where the state of Washington sends and holds people who are diagnosed as sexually violent predators. Now, the Special Commitment Center on McNeil Island isn't a prison, but the people who are sent there are often kept there for life. Entman and his co-producer, Bethany Denton, devoted a recent episode of Here Be Monsters to the Special Commitment Center on McNeil Island. And Bill Radke asked them how the state of Washington can legally hold people there, even people found guilty of committing terrible crimes with no prison sentence involved. We'll hear from Bethany first.
So the legal justification is that civil commitment is intended to be rehabilitative and not punitive. And that means that because of the Special Commitment Center, for instance, offers treatment, it does not violate double jeopardy, which means that it's not strictly a punishment, a continued punishment for someone who has already served time.
There have been a lot of Supreme Court cases. SCC residents themselves have challenged this all the way to Supreme Court. One was claiming inadequate treatment, but again, it was dismissed because treatment was being offered, regardless of how sparse that treatment was.
Let's meet somebody in this situation. A character in your story is Chris, And for years, he was defined as a sexually violent predator. And on the podcast, you withheld his last name for his protection and his family's protection. He was ultimately released from the facility on McNeil Island after his trial. Why were you drawn to Chris's story?
What I particularly found really fascinating about Chris is that he was sent to the Special Commitment Center when he was 18 years old. He had been convicted and served a two-year sentence as a juvenile in a juvenile facility, but then was sent subsequently to the SCC on McNeil Island, the Special Commitment Center. And so, you know, now he's 36. This is a person who has never used the internet, never used a cell phone. He never had a job. In a lot of ways, he's 36 going on 19. And so this is a person who is about to embark on adulthood for the first time really ever in his life. He in a lot of ways is a stunted adolescent. And so part of the story was just interesting in and of itself.
Now, you know, Chris is he did the crime, right? He's mm-hmm. classified as a sexually violent predator. He's hurt a lot of people. He admitted to sexually assaulting his sisters and many other people. And he was ultimately released after his trial. One of the central questions of your story is whether or not people can change after doing something reprehensible. So what kind of answers did you come across?
You know, this is a topic that just has so many different perspectives on it. When I was originally thinking about what kind of questions we could ask about this topic, I assumed there were just these two perspectives. One is that we're just kind of these old babies that are walking around with layers of ways to cope with the different stressors that exist in the world.
Meaning those coping ways are not going to change? They're fixed?
Well, the coping ways would change, but the fundamental deviances that we have, the fundamental insecurities that we have are the same. The other perspective that I ran across, or I thought existed, were that humans are just entirely fluid all throughout our lives, and that we're just constantly shifting and reinventing ourselves. And throughout the course of reporting this, I came to realize that this isn't the only two options there are. Of course, there are many ways to view the ways in which people change. But the two main people that we talked to, one was a public defender named Andrew Morrison. The second was the head of the Sexually Violent Predators Unit at King County Prosecutors named Jennifer Ritchie. And the two of them had very differing perspectives on Chris. They had very differing perspectives on criminal justice, and they had very differing perspectives on that question of how do people change throughout their lives, or do they? So when we talked to the prosecutor in interview, Jennifer Ritchie, she told us, you know, people can change. People do change. She just didn't think that Chris did.
In our experience, because of his lack of treatment and because of our experience in seeing his history, you know, I'm not going to say we should be afraid of Christopher, because I'm certainly not going to, you know, fearmonger about Christopher, but it is keeping our fingers crossed. I mean, I hope to God to never see Christopher again, because if I see Christopher again, it means that Christopher is taking part in activities that are highly, highly risky behaviors.
And the public defender, Andrew Morrison, when we talked to him in interview, he kind of thought this whole idea of sorting things out into this dichotomy, he thought that was kind of a bogus way of approaching things. And what he told us instead is he said, people respond to their environment. And he thinks that instead of locking people up on this island, we're going to have better results if we invest this money that we're spending on people in their communities and into individual people instead.
I think that, you know, in terms of becoming healthy people, what it's really about is learning ways to cope successfully without hurting other people. Human beings are social creatures. There is no one that is an island unto themselves that is better off isolated, who functions better that way. And the further we get away from that, the more unhealthy and the more dangerous we become.
As far as long-term recidivism goes, we just have a couple studies to look at here. And there's a big one that followed a large set of sex offenders that were all released in the year 1994. And it's kind of followed them ever since. And what that study found was that sex offenders as a whole are much less likely than other kinds of criminals to reoffend. That also has to be understood through the filter of knowing that, as Jennifer Ritchie rightly points out, that sex offenses are underreported. So it's kind of this confusing area where you can't take a statistic and apply it to a single person, especially a person as unique as Christopher, in that he only offended as a child. And there's some evidence, again, I don't think Beth or I are the right people to comment on its scientific validity, but there is data that suggests that juvenile-only sex offenders are completely different than their adult counterparts. So as far as like this question that I think a lot of people ask when they listen to this piece, is Chris going to reoffend again? It's a hard question to answer with data, but you can kind of get these little glimpses of the truth. Predicting the future is a dangerous game, especially when it's specific, especially when it's about a person. But that's essentially what the jury was asked to do.
That was Jeff Empman and Bethany Denton. They're the Seattle-based producers of the podcast Here Be Monsters from KCRW's Independent Producer Project. You can hear the full episode on McNeil Island and check out photos from their story on our website. That's where you can find all the stories you heard on today's show. And that's The Record on KUOW for today. I'm Jeannie Yandel in for Bill Radke. Thanks for listening.